listening to Coast AM with Ian Punnett.
That should be a very interesting night. Glenn Kimball will join us here in just a minute. The story takes a lot of twists and turns. I can't wait to get into it. It's a story that involves Nazis, a Da Vinci Code-like revelation, not to mention an ongoing concern that whoever it is that talks and promotes and publishes these documents may end up the object of a fatwa. So, you know, there's a lot of academic and scholarly interest in this, a lot of universities that will be scared by the politically incorrect implications of the research, will be afraid for the professors. People who may be doing the research may have to do so under fake names to avoid terroristic threats. So explosive is the material we're about to get to next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Hey, before I grab Glenn Kimball here, I just want to jump in and say I learn everything on Coast to Coast through trial and error, and so I was in error. I didn't realize that Ron Paul had made an appearance with George a couple of months ago. My apologies. When the caller said that, saying, you know, you got to get Ron Paul on the show, I was still assuming that he hadn't. And I don't always hear about every show because of the nature of my work during the week. But I should have known about that one, so my bad. And glad that Ron Paul made an appearance. I wish all the candidates did. I'm still hoping for Dennis Kucinich to come on to Coast AM and talk about his UFO experiences. But that will wait for another day. Glenn Kimball is here, what exactly is your title over at Kimball College?
Me?
Yeah. What's your title?
I guess I'm the owner.
The owner of Kimball College. Well, no, aren't you supposed to be like provost, or supposed to be like, aren't you supposed to have some sort of academic title?
If you name me the provost, then I have to carry my pistols, you know.
So. Okay, all right. Glenn Kimball, how's your health? I heard you had a little bit of a cold this week.
Well, you know, you get old, Ian. We are getting old, my good friend, you know. And I have grandkids now that live around me, and they bring every disease home from school imaginable.
Yes.
When I lived with just me and my wife alone here, I never got sick. But but the grandkids knock on my door every morning and want it their popsicle. So.
Yep. They're walking Petri dishes.
They are indeed.
Yep. Yeah, you got to be careful of that. So are we going to get killed if we do this show? Are we going to end up dead?
No, we're not going to end up. I can tell you right now that possibility is very real, though. A couple of years ago, after one of the shows, I had a brand new Cadillac pull up to my house outside my porch, and four guys in trench coats got out. Now, this is the summer in Arizona. People don't wear trench coats in the summertime. They got out. One of the gentlemen had a high-def cam, and the other three had machine guns.
Oh, get out. What show was this after that they did this?
Well, I'm not going to mention it because I agreed not to. But
are you serious?
I'm serious. I mean, they came out, and I waved them over. You know, I'm the junkyard dog of history, you know. I waved them over. I said, come on in, guys. I mean, don't stand out there in the heat. Let's come on in the air conditioning.
And did you see their machine guns as they got out of the car?
Absolutely.
Okay. Why would they need to bring machine guns to you?
I don't know. I honestly don't know who they were, because all they did was stick a high def cam in my face, and I waved at them and said some nice things, and invited them in for a beverage of their choice, and they took some video of me, and I said, guys, why don't you come in and spend a little bit of time? We'll have a chat. Most people would be frightened of that, but you know, after all the things that have happened to me in my life. You run from the junkyard dog, he chases you. You sit down and pet him, he's a lot friendlier. And so that's always been my M.O.
So what did they just took some video of you and then they left?
Well, they drove about 100 feet down the parking lot, stopped and got out, and looked at me again. And I tried to wave them back, and they wouldn't come back in. They wouldn't pull back, but they did wave to me as they left. I don't know what they were doing.
That's really weird.
It may have been a Hollywood group trying to get some sort of action sequence for Indiana Jones. I have
or
no idea.
Maybe they were looking for the next big Hollywood star, and they so they come in to get a quick videotape.
I don't think either one of us is Hollywood stars.
I'd like to hear. I'd really want to hear more about this story. It's so interesting to me, and I was so glad that you had been following the story anyway, because I was dying to find a conversation partner on this. And so you're perfect for this, Glenn. We're talking about ancient Quranic manuscripts that do not jibe with, reportedly, the text of the Quran as it is shared by billions of faithful Muslims around the world.
Well, that's true. There are really two parts to answer that question, but to set the record straight, there are really six different versions of the Quran available. Now, if you're Islam, they don't call it versions. They call it recitations to soften that the discrepancy. But in reality, for example, these versions are very distinct. If you take the Book of the Parties, for example, the original Book of the Parties, according to people who were disciples of Muhammad himself, The Quran we have today has roughly 70 verses in that chapter under parties. The original text of the Quran, as dictated by Muhammad, had over 200 verses in it. So what happened to the rest of them?
Right.
You know, and so the version we have in our day of the Quran really comes from Uthman. Uthman was the third generation caliph after Muhammad. And he sent out an edict saying that my version is the only one available. He made five different copies of it, refused to allow anybody to read it per se. People could memorize it and recite it, but they weren't allowed to investigate it. And he sent out an edict to have all the rest of the versions of the Quran destroyed. He didn't accomplish that task perfectly, because there was a version of the Quran taken to China. There was a version taken to Kyrgyzstan up in Russia, and these are as old as the ones that were authored and proposed by Uthman.
Well, then where is the threat to people who are more on the more conservative side of Islam? Why would any other version of this than coming out now? Why would this research that has just been revived in Germany with the rediscovery of an ancient text, why would that be considered any threat at all?
Well, it's the old saying that we can parallel that with the Bible. We can say that the Bible, the Christ became the flesh of the text. They say the Quran became the text of the recitation of the vision, and according to these beliefs, they believe that the Bible and the Quran were in fact the literal words of God, and that anyone messing with these words of God was messing with something extremely important. And we have to forgive them, because that process hasn't been is imperfect, to say the least.
Well, there's plenty of people that would say that today about, and then fill in the blank. I mean, whether it's the Book of Mormon, whether it's the King James version of the Bible, there are some people that believe that that is the only version of the Bible that should ever exist. It was perfect, and everything else is a corruption. I mean, there are lots of different investments that people make in arguments like that.
Yeah, and they have the Septuagint, which was the original ancient Greek version that the Nicene Council used to generate the Old Testament. And
right.
I have people contacting me all the time saying, can you give me the most original version of the Bible? And I said, do you have a copy of the Septuagint? And that's readily available on my site, and probably in bookstores around the world, if you get one that knows what they're doing. But the reality of the matter is, who cares? You know, the message is the same. We have to look at what really happened here, because there's a couple of really important secrets here that we want to talk about on this program today.
I do.
Barn burners that have to do with the Da Vinci Code, for example. Really.
Well, let's set the table then, and you choose where along the timeline you want to get started with this story, because we could go back, depending on where you want, or maybe we just start someplace and then we reserve the right to digress later on.
Well, you certainly have always, you and I are always kind of like we sing harmony to each other's melody. So I've always felt that about you, Ian.
Well, good. Well, let's you start then you do the lead vocal here. I mean, when do you start this story?
Well, let's look at who Muhammad really was, first of all. Muhammad came in the 7th century A.D., He came after the time of the fall of the Roman Empire. He came at the time when Christianity and Judaism were very separate religions, had enormous amounts of political and religious and cultural strife between them. This is the time, by the way, of King Arthur and his brother Madoc, who by the way settled in Mobile, Alabama. And people don't realize.
Wait, whoa. That is such a Glenn Kimball moment. King Arthur's brother settled in Mobile, Alabama.
Well, I didn't invent that. They still have the celebration there.
Okay, but how does King Arthur's brother end up in Mobile, Alabama?
Well, you and I have to do a show on that one of these days. But his brother Madoc. I mean, I'm not the travel bureau for Mobile, Alabama.
I'm not saying he made it up. I'm just saying, like, how does that happen? What year does he end up in Mobile, Alabama?
In the 6th century A.D.
Okay, so he makes it. King Arthur's brother makes it all the way to Mobile, Alabama in the 6th century.
Yeah, this is about the time of Muhammad, okay?
Okay, all
so
right.
We give it some context, some flavor here, okay?
All right.
We're
okay.
Talking about well before Christopher Columbus here.
Right, well, I get that part. Okay, so,
and
so
it
let's...
it comes right in the middle of the instigation and the life expectancy of some very, very large libraries. For example, the library in Beijing, China, was found during the time of Muhammad. This library in China not only contained all the writings of Confucius and the dogmas of the Tao, but it contained an entire huge collection of the words of Jesus and his instructions to Peter and his descriptions of the Ten Commandments. We have those things in our day and age. These libraries from China, which is amazing. I mean, this is so sensational and stunning that it's going to make people wonder what in the heck we're talking about, you know. But those, my son and I have done a class on that library that exists. But that comes at the time of Muhammad's life, okay?
Right. Okay.
So Muhammad was born. His dad died when he was about just 6 months before he was born. His mother died when he was 6 years old. And so he was really basically an orphan from an itinerant family. That means a lower class family. And if you know anything about the Arabic community, they place a great deal of importance on their heritage and the power of their father and their lineage and those kinds of things. And in essence, Muhammad was left abandoned alone, an orphan. By the time he was 6 years old. So for him to have risen to be the premier figure in the Arabic world, in the Islamic world, is in itself a miraculous event.
Okay.
So he's born in Mecca. He sees all of these religions that are Arabic in nature, that they drew from India, they drew from Africa, they drew from a variety from Egypt, these mystical religions which were often called pagan by Western Christianity, which I think is probably an inappropriate term.
Sure, it's not entirely accurate, but these would have been nomadic religions that were sometimes in conflict with each other because they might have been associated with one warlord over another warlord.
Right, and in essence, Muhammad developed mastered a great deal of money through merchant traffic. He was a camel aficionado, sold camels, launched caravans, and he was right there in Mecca, right in the throat of the traffic, the merchant traffic from the east to the west. And so this little teeny obscure town of Mecca was getting filthy rich off the trade from east to west at that particular moment in history. which is just fine. I think that's wonderful. It's honorable to have gold. You know, I wish that someone would honor me as much, you know.
Maybe that's what the guys with the machine guns were going to bring you. But anyway.
Yeah, right, well, so, next time I'm going to charge. I didn't pay him not to shoot me.
So here's what happened. So Muhammad at some point has a receives the word of God. We're not quite there yet. Okay, go ahead.
He's developed this business where he gets a lot of money and he gets a following of people who work for him in the camel business, but also who listen to his wisdom, because he speaks out against all of these mystical religions in Mecca. And in essence, is run out of town for all intents and purposes, and has to spend enormous amounts of time in Medina to the north, because the people in Mecca hated being criticized by Muhammad, because they, at that moment in time, Islam did not exist. What eventually happened, though, is he returned to Mecca, and he had a peculiar custom, which was not peculiar at all to Judaism and Christianity. He had this custom of going to these sacred places and meditating in these temple-like structures and seeing visions. Now, that's what the temples were all about. They were schools. They were places you could go and dream your dreams and have your visions and have your communication with deity. And so Muhammad was doing the very same thing that the Jews did in the Temple of Solomon, that the Egyptians did in the temples of Armana, which, by the way, were the exact replica of the Temple of Solomon. And they also, the temple in Armana in Egypt also once housed the Ark of the Covenant. We think the Ark of the Covenant was built in the deserts of the Sinai. It was not. It was built and housed in the shrines at Armana. But Muhammad had heard about this process about how to gain knowledge. And by the way, the kinds of knowledge that you got from these visions wasn't just religious. The kinds of knowledge that you would get would be things like astronomy, mathematics, agriculture, medicine. These people were learning a great deal from these experiences. In fact, the libraries prior to one of the greatest libraries in the history of the world was the Ionian Library. It was prior to the Alexandria Library. We name an atomical particle an ion. An ion's named after these Ionian library documents, which describe atoms and electrons in a fashion that they didn't have telescope or microscopes to be able to observe. So these people, and where did they get all this knowledge from? They got it from this process that Muhammad used to discover, to learn not only about religion, but about mathematics, obviously, and all the other sciences. They had 9 different courses of studies in these places. So one night when he was in Mecca, he left Mecca, went to his favorite temple spot, had this vision of Gabriel, which was very coincidental, very parallel, because remember, it was Gabriel who announced to Joseph and Mary the coming of the birth of Jesus. It was Gabriel who taught Daniel the dreams, taught him how to interpret dreams at the time of Daniel. Gabriel's the guy who is a very common messenger for these kinds of events. And so Muhammad had this experience where it came in two parts. First of all...
Well, hang on to that. That's just going to lead us right up to where we'll break. We'll come right up to that discussion about the deliverance of the message from the Archangel Gabriel. But what if scholars can prove that the Quran was not dictated by the Archangel Gabriel to Muhammad during the 7th century, as Glenn Kimball has been telling us, but rather the Quran was assembled by later writers drawing on a variety of sources, some of which were Christian, some of which were Jewish, some of which may have come from Muhammad. What if that could ever be proven? We'll get to that coming up. That's the explosive nature of the discussion tonight and the new developments of the last week in Europe on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.
To access the audio archives of Coast to Coast AM, log on to coasttocoastam.com. Coast AM with Ian Punnett.
Talking with Glenn Kimball. We'll get back to the conversation coming up in just a second about Islam, about the Quran specifically. It's a story that involves Nazis. It involves the suppression of documents, not unlike the Da Vinci Code. The difference is, whereas there is room to speculate on the truth of the claims of a book like the Da Vinci Code, this could end up being something much more devastating if it's ever allowed to come out. And that's another question we'll talk about, too, next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So the story Glenn Kimball is telling us brings us into a very important piece of the puzzle for the developments of this week. We're talking about Muhammad's revelation from the Archangel Gabriel, as the story goes. This is the same Archangel Gabriel that we hear, you know, bringing other annunciations in the Christian Bible. So, all right, so Glenn, pick that up there then, that Muhammad says that this has been delivered to him, this resuscitation has happened, and then what happens then?
Well, during his lifetime, Muhammad was illiterate in terms of not being able to write, but he dictated this recitation to his followers who did have scribal capability. And during his lifetime, they did write it down. That doesn't mean that the Quran that we have today is the exact same thing that was written down during his life, because Uthman, who eventually gave us what we have as the Quran today, was the third generation imam or caliph after Muhammad. And so many of the renditions that we have in our day and age really come from between 120 years and 200 years after, 280 years actually, after the death of Muhammad. But what really happened in this story is that two German archaeologists were in Yemen at the site of Sana'a, where there was a great mosque. And they
in what
were,
year?
This is over 60 years ago. This is just okay. Before the Second World War.
Okay.
It's between the First World War and the Second World War.
And these are Nazi scientists or just scientists?
Very much
with
Nazi sympathizers.
Okay.
And by the way, the Germany and the Ottoman Empire had a natural alliance with each other at that point, though they were not allies during the First World War. They became allies during the Second World War because of their mutual disdain for the Jewish communities.
So because of anti-Semitism, they were joined at the hip ideologically, and Hitler was sending out scientists all over the globe, trying to find things which would help the Nazi cause.
And you know what he really did? We need to back up in the story of Hitler for a moment. Even before he was a paper hanger, as he was growing up, he had the custom of going to the local pawn shop or used book dealer and trading in his – he was poor. He was not raised rich. He would trade in the books that he had to this mystic who owned this used bookstore, and they would trade books back and forth. And the mentor of the store would teach him about what was important. And he had all of the books, all the mystical books about alchemy. He had all the books about Christianity. He even had the stories of the Quran itself. And so Hitler gained an early appreciation for these events that happened, these processes of gaining knowledge and power. And he also knew about I lose my tongue here for a moment.
It's okay. If I had any idea where you were going with that, I would jump in, but I don't.
The prophet of the Black Death, he had the quatrain verses.
Oh, you mean Nostradamus?
Nostradamus. Nostradamus okay. Predicted that a great man would be born at a certain day, gave the actual date of the year. And Hitler, by the way, was born on that day, and so he assumed that he was going to be the antecedent of this prophecy of Nostradamus.
I'd never heard that before.
You had never heard that before?
No, I'd never heard that Hitler had read Nostradamus, yeah, and knew that that was his birthday.
Mm. He knew very well who Nostradamus was because of his mentor in this bookstore. And so when he went out to collect the things that would vindicate his position as the leader of the Germanic movement, or eventually the Nazi movement, they adopted the swastika. The swastika was really a symbol from India.
Yeah, Hindu, Indo-European or Hindu symbol.
Yeah.
It also pops up in the temples in Japan, too. It's a symbol for life, isn't it?
So he didn't just pull that out of his hat. He pulled that out of his early training with this mentor of this bookstore as a symbol of his own greatness. And so one of the most important things that he did in his life was to target libraries when he went out to conquer Austria, etc. He went out to target libraries. Not only great paintings and gold and those kinds of things, which would have been obvious, but he went out to collect history in order to vindicate his own cause because he really felt like he was destined to be some sort of messianic figure, which
right.
is preposterous, obviously.
But it bolstered their mythic claims that that the Nazi Party was making and then extending through their violence, that the more violent and the more extravagant you get militarily, the more you need to be able to bolster your right to be able to do it.
That's right. And so two of these, Poonen and Botham, who were the Nazi sympathizers who were doing this excavation down in Yemen, they were tearing off the roof and almost used as insulation. They found this enormous library. This library, they call it the paper tomb. It was not the tomb of an individual because it was very amoral for a body to be buried in a mosque, unlike in Christianity where we can bury the popes in a cathedral or
anybody in a church that under certain traditions can be buried in a church
or in the church courtyard. I mean, you can't even
right.
you can't be buried in a at the site of a mosque. That would be defiling it.
Right. And there's columbariums in churches, all sorts of different churches. We put the ashes or the whole body in there.
Exactly. But they did call it the paper tomb. And the reason why they called it the paper tomb is that these were the remnants of some of the very first Qurans that were in existence. Now, you have to remember that the Quran under Uthman sent out an edict that if one of the versions, he actually made five versions, five copies. We didn't have Gutenberg's printing press at that time, so we didn't have mass market publication capability. He made five copies of them, and one of those copies, obviously, was put in the roof of this mosque in Sana'a, and along with lots of other documents. It filled 20 potato sacks, they said. And they were so extant. But to get back to this, Uthman said that if a copy of the Quran even had a hole in it or had a page missing, that it had to be destroyed, because then it was not the perfect word of God if it was missing something, okay?
Right.
But by the time of this Germanic discovery at Sana'a in Yemen, they found all of these documents, and they realized the importance of these documents, and they began to take photographs of them. They took 450 rolls of film, very long film, by the way, and took them back to Germany. And the Germans, obviously Hitler appreciated what this was. Some people say that Hitler didn't even know that they had it. It is my contention that he knew very well what he had in his possession. He didn't want to offend his Islamic allies, and so he kept it very secret.
Okay, now let's do something again. What is it that's so offensive about this particular, the microfilm they have of these documents? What is it that's on there that would have caused a rift between Hitler and his Muslim allies at the time?
Well, first of all, the version that was found in Yemen was a more eloquent version. It was written in the poetic style of Arabic, as opposed to a very common street style of Arabic, which is with our Quran today. It's the more common language for the people, but the more eloquent language was on these particular documents. But once again, it was their conservative opinion that this was the word of God dictated by Muhammad, and that anyone who changed even a syllable of this thing was tampering with the very word of God. And it was a great offense to them, especially to have a version that did not agree with the version of Uthman come out into the public, because it would have been a great offense to them.
And so the version that they find in this mosque is it's not an Uthman version?
No.
Okay, and it's radically different than the Uthman version, which is commonly used by the Muslim world.
I don't think it's radically different at all. I think that it's different in the sense that it's shorter, but in essence, it contains. It's almost like the King James Version versus the
NIV or the
version,
right,
of the Bible. For me, I wouldn't have had any problem with it. But in Islam, they had enormous problems if you changed one jot or tittle of it.
Right.
Can I give you an example of what I'm talking about?
Oh yeah, please do.
The word hure, which is the word that the jihadists use when you follow the will of God and you die for the will of Allah, you know, you sacrifice your life in these bombings. They say that when you do this, that you go to heaven and get this hur, H-U-R. Now, they have interpreted it in the Al-Qaeda version as huri, with an I on the end of it. Now, huri means virgin. In other words, they claim that when they go to paradise that they're going to be given all these virgins, okay?
Right.
But the original word hur really means white or white fruit or white grapes. And that's very common. That was the most popular dictionary denotative definition of the word at the time of Muhammad. And so what Al-Qaeda has done today is they've changed that particular word to mean that if you go out and bomb yourself in the public square, that you're going to be given all these virgins or some ridiculous thing.
Okay, but wait. Now, Al-Qaeda has changed that, or in the version that exists, the common Quran that exists in any Muslim household, that it says huri in that Quran, but in the other Quran it says hur.
The Quran that we have today still says hur. They've interpreted this meaning hurdy.
Okay, but so the Quran today still says H-U-R.
Yeah.
So to speak. Okay, if we're going to transliterate it. Okay, so this is why this is – but why is that different in 19 – pre-Al-Qaeda – in, you know, in pre-World War II Germany, why would a difference like that be a threat to a Muslim nation that Hitler would personally bury this version of it that was found in order to not create a rift?
You put your finger on it. For us in the Western world, there is no problem. But from an Islamic perspective, there is a problem.
Well, I was trying to think of another example that would point out the difference then, pre-World War II. Were there any other examples that you've been able to find that indicate that passages, well-known passages or understandings in the modern Quran are wrong in comparison to this older version that was found?
Well, like I said, that there were some 100 passages from the Book of Parties that are missing.
Okay.
In our version that were in the original version at the time of Muhammad. So
okay.
The longer version is the older version.
Okay. So there are things in this other book that are there, other words that are changed, but the bottom line is the fact that it's different is a threat to the belief that the Quran that is used today is uncorrupted as opposed to the Bible, which many people in Islam would say, certainly Muhammad's opinion was, that it was a ruined version of God's word.
Yeah.
A version that was ruined by human intervention and editorializing over time, and that would seem to imply that the same thing has happened to the Quran.
Well, the Quran, as I said, had seven different versions of the Quran. We can identify seven different versions of it.
Do they know that in the Islamic world? I mean, do they openly talk about that?
They openly call it seven different renditions.
Okay.
Recitations,
right.
Excuse me.
Right.
Seven
right.
Different recitations.
All right, so let's go back to 1938. So Hitler does bury this, and the supposedly the is either the film destroyed or what happens to this film of this Quran? What do we know about it?
The film's still there. They still have copies of the photographs.
Yeah, I know, but didn't Hitler order it destroyed, and then it wasn't, and I thought I remember. I'm going to go back. I'm going to pull up this.
He did.
The article. What's that?
He did. But it's still in existence. The copies of the photographs still are in existence, and you can find it on the net in some different places. Actual photographic copies of the Son of manuscripts.
Okay. And so now we have sort of a unique – we can take a moment here. This parallels the kind of thing you're up against all the time, right? I mean, you as a researcher of lost ancient documents, this is a very familiar story.
It's an old, old, old story, enormously familiar to me. As I told Art Bell 10 years ago, we were tracking 5 million documents that dealt with Jesus – were either written by Jesus, his apostles, disciples, or people who knew him. That sounds like a preposterous claim, but unfortunately it's not preposterous at all. John said it best in John 21:25. He says, "And many things Jesus did, I suppose, if they were all written, the world itself could not contain all the books that should be written." Probably a very similar thing on a minor scale is true with the Quran. We could all the books that should be written about the Quran would be enormous about the history of Muhammad. There are six different versions of his life, for example, that vary and tell us different stories. There are people that say that he actually visited Jerusalem and had this vision of the ascension with Gabriel, which came in two parts. Most of the real historic world believes that he didn't get there at all, but it's my opinion that he probably did. He probably did get to Jerusalem. After all, he was a camel merchant, involved in merchant traffic and trade. That's how he made his life.
Sure.
And it would not have been uncommon for him to have traveled a short distance to Jerusalem and have known very well about the Temple Mount.
Right. Very interesting. Now, and that's, again, though, it comes down to, you know, things like that. It doesn't sound terribly surprising, or to the Western ear, it's not controversial to hear alternate views of the life of Jesus or to discuss what aspects of the New Testament might or might not be true, historically accurate, what might have gotten shifted, any of that sort of thing. It's not an uncommon discussion in the West.
In our day and age, that's true, but that's not always been the case now.
No, remember, that's a good point.
At the time of the Nicene Council, and up until just 150, 200 years ago, the reading of the Bible was banned.
Well, let's go ahead and then take this back, though, after the top of the hour to what's going on right now with this document and why this is this alternate Quranic document that has been rediscovered after it had been reportedly destroyed, that this document is causing so many ripples in the academic community. What is it exactly that's going to happen with this document? Nobody knows for sure, but we'll run down some of the most recent developments about it and who's fighting to still keep it suppressed. Next, with Glenn Kimball. I will tell you, too, at coasttocoastam.com, I put the blog up from earlier this evening from Crypto News. If you want to click onto that if you missed the Crypto News stories.
And the world is a window gone underground. There's a hole in the sky where the sun don't shine. And a clock on the wall and it counts my time. And never
Networks presents Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett. Now, here's Ian.
We're talking with Glenn Kimball about his expertise, his lens on ancient manuscripts and what it tells us about this big story this week about the revelation that, in fact, there are existing photographic copies of an alternate Quranic text. We'll get into that coming up in just a second and what the implications are. For academia, how hard it will be for this to be studied openly, according to critics, and I'll read you an interesting piece written about that, too, in just a minute. Great stories, by the way, on the website. If you go to coasttocoastam.com, you'll look for the link to the story about that UFO sighting in Turkey, and watch that video. I think that that is got to be a separate upcoming Coast to Coast stories. Seems like right now, Texas, Turkey, a couple other places in Europe, these sightings are coming with many more video and photographic evidence. What a difference it makes. And where would we be with this Quranic discussion if somebody hadn't had a microfilm and then not destroyed it? And we'll talk about that next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So I thought it was interesting. We were talking about these Nazi Arabic scholars that had a copy of this alternate Quranic text and had been guarding it so that it couldn't be examined, so that you couldn't read it as a university scholar, as an academic, and look for variations in the text. You couldn't look for more versions of words that may have been misinterpreted over time or other scribal errors which may have caused ripples within the within Islamic theology because it was such a threat to the alliance between Islam and, at the time, Adolf Hitler's Germany. And I thought what was really interesting, Glenn, was that even after World War II, a lot of these original Nazi scholars remained in high academic positions throughout Germany, and they were still, seemingly because of this a shared belief and antisemitism, they were still withholding what they knew or availability to these documents well into the 1970s.
Well, that's certainly true. We have to remember that even though the publicly Hitler may have said that he ordered the destruction of these documents. What he said in public and what he did in private were two very different things. He would never have destroyed anything this precious that came into his possession. Hitler was, he had an enormous collection of things that he had taken from around the world that were kept in salt mines in Germany that still haven't been all returned.
Right. Well, I want to read a little bit more from this article. I found this one at a website, an Assyrian news website, and this is how they phrased it. Why were the Nazis so eager to suppress Quranic criticism? Most likely, and we talked about the anti-Semitism thing, but it goes on to say that the one author makes a bold and consequential statement about this, and that is, and I just lost my place, the dissemination of European models of anti-Semitism among Muslims was not haphazard, but an actual project of the Nazi Party to create more anti-Semitism, essentially, amongst Muslims, meant to turn Muslims against Jews and Zionism. He says that in the years before World War II, two Muslim leaders in particular willingly and knowingly carried Nazi ideology directly to the Muslim masses. And he has their name here. They were people who were founders of the Muslim Brotherhood. And I'll go on to read. It may be a very long time before the contents of any of these archives are known. Some Quranic critics, notably the pseudonymous scholar Ibn Marak, claim that a Professor Angelica Newworth, the archives custodian, has denied access to scholars who stray from traditional interpretation. So you have to agree to interpret it the correct way before they'll even let you look at it. And I think this is, again, this speaks to what's going to happen if, as we know this week, this is no longer, it's a cat that gets out of the bag, and there won't be one scholar or a group of scholars that have access to this this other Quranic text, but it'll be out for the world to see.
Well, the thing that amazes me is that this isn't the first time that there have been evidence that there were variations in the Quran. Scholars have been saying this for decades. The fact that this is some sort of a news story is semi-preposterous because they have been studying the variations and the various Quranic finds in China and in Russia and other places for decades and decades. The fact that this particular one was kept by the Nazis, I think, has really brought it to the forefront of the paparazzi, so to speak.
I'm not sure you get that. You may be right, but I look at what some of the claims made by alternative Quranic scholars, and what they're saying is we don't know what's in it yet. We don't know how different the texts are yet because they've been so secretive about them.
And these particular texts, you're right.
Yeah, and I think that's the part.
I'm saying that these aren't unique in being different. There are other versions.
Right, but they may be so different. And the separation, now we don't know that. They could end up not being that way. But it seems the amount of effort that's been put forth by generations of Nazi-sympathizing scholars in Germany would seem to indicate that there's something explosive about it, that if there wasn't, why wouldn't they just have let it out, decades ago?
Well, And I must respectfully disagree a little bit on this.
Go ahead.
Not 180 degrees against that particular position. But we really live in the day of the Islamic Inquisition. We've already gone through a Christian Inquisition.
Right.
Some centuries ago, where anybody that differed from the Catholic or the universal definition of the Bible was considered a heretic and worthy of being burned at the stake, and the Templars were exterminated for all intents and purposes as an entity in 1307 because they had in their possession a library in Great Britain that was very different than that of the Vatican,
sure.
A great deal larger than that of the Vatican. And in fact, it was so much larger that the largest library of Jesus that still exists in our world today still is in Great Britain and is not in the Vatican.
Right.
I spoke with the head of the British Israel Society, their representatives from Great Britain, as early as today. And they told me about the hundreds and hundreds of volumes that they're going to be publishing in this coming year that will be on my website. But there are this is a site where there were huge libraries, enormous libraries. And the reason why there was an enormous library was because after the death of Jesus, when Joseph of Arimathea took the famous personalities for their own protection into self-imposed exile into Great Britain, they were given the 12 hides of Glastonbury, which is roughly 2,000 acres. This became a sovereign nation for 1,000 years. They didn't pay taxes to the British crown until Henry II.
Right.
And following Henry II, Edward I took over, and Edward I was Longshanks from Braveheart fame.
Sure.
And carried out this extermination order of the Templars. And they had to go underground and change their name, and many of them, much of what they believed in, many of their texts went into Scotland and became integrated with Freemasonry and other movements, and so we know what they had. I think it's kind of interesting to know, we get back to this Da Vinci Code thing for a moment. Henry Lincoln made an interesting comment. He was, if you know who Henry Lincoln was.
Sure, he's one of the co-authors of the Holy Blood, Holy Grail.
Right, and that Holy Blood, Holy Grail was, for all intents and purposes, one of the foundations of Dan Brown's book called The Da Vinci Code. But he made an amazing statement that was aired on the television here in my area last week. He said there were really two secrets of the Da Vinci Code. One was the Rennes-le-Château comments that Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene, which was, by the way, an old story because we have Sanhedrin documents which talk about Jesus's courtship of Mary Magdalene that come from 2,000 years ago that are very much from the Vatican and the Hagia Sophia shared in common.
Right.
But the fact remains that Joseph went there and he began a school. And the school began collecting manuscripts. They already had some manuscripts in Great Britain at that time.
You mean Joseph of Arimathea goes there?
He goes there and he starts a school.
Right.
And whenever you see school, that means they collected manuscripts. And they already had the old Lamfadla documents, which were the documents where Jeremiah had visited Great Britain with Tetefi in tow, which was the daughter of Zedekiah, who escaped the Babylonian conquest. That's why Jesus' grandmother, the great Saint Anna, really came from Britannia and not necessarily was born in Jerusalem or thereabouts.
Well, even what you're saying right there, as that may not be agreed upon by all Christians or people of, or for that matter, historians, they may not agree with that, but you can have that discussion and I can have that discussion, and that is the essential difference. That what you're talking about there is what the church would refer to as either a heresy or a heterodoxy. You're talking about an alternate version, another version of the story.
Well, we have manuscripts to that effect.
Oh, I'm with you. But my point is that that's so interesting because that we compare that to the case here of this Quranic document,
exactly,
which is just resurfaced, and there is no allowed alternate version. In fact, you know, even in discussing this one particular version of the Quran, which they have on microfilm, which just resurfaced this week, scholars who wondered about what was on it would get fired. You know, people that had tried to get access to it could get fired from their academic positions. That's how explosive this is.
Well, it is enormously explosive because of jihad. I mean, how would you like to be a school and be under the threat of your Islamic community coming in and bombing your campus, which is a real possibility?
Or having even in the West, and this is the point that a couple of the articles have made about this, the Wall Street Journal doing a piece we referenced to earlier, where these Arabic studies departments or, you know, various, you know, combinations where you're doing Middle Eastern studies or Quranic studies, they're all funded by the Middle East. And anybody that attempts to deviate from an orthodoxy, even at the academic level on public universities, can risk losing their funding. So, I mean, there's a lot of control that's going on about this that seems to be intended to support one particular religious view, and that is, you know, the luxury of maintaining that there is no version other than the Quran, the popular version of the Quran, Quran that is authorized by God.
And you know what amazes me, and when you say that, I hear you saying that, it makes me question the courage of our scholastic community.
Yeah, okay.
how courageous are they to reshape history based on being threatened physically? And that it's really possible that that could occur. And yet it's a reality. It's a reality in our day. We are still running from this. You cannot do it in America. You can't go to Harvard University and say we're going to start this study and get funded or get the approval of the administrators or the dean of the department because they don't want to have the Arabic community raise up and cause a problem on campus.
Well, this speaks to another story, and it's pardon everybody for this sidebar, but I thought it was very interesting that one California university had been proposing that all of their staff, all their faculty and staff, sign a pledge which was one that would hold them to a non-judgmental position on beliefs. That is to say that not any one belief on campus could be promoted above any other. And the pushback that came from the faculty was, well, then this means that fascism or racism or sexism deserves as much time on the campus as any of these other belief systems. And the school says, well, we don't mean that. But, I mean, it just goes to show you that there is – it seems like there's some sort of scholastic cowardice that goes on at the university level in many cases, private and public, because there is a philosophy or a theology from the top of the university that they're trying to get the rest of the school to maintain for them. And that may not it may be absolutely inaccurate, or it may be, you know, that the beliefs of the university at the top are protecting something and the rest of the faculty is going to have to go along with it or leave.
That's absolutely correct, and there are other examples we can give of that very same phenomena. Under John Wesley Powell, who was commissioned by the United States government to go out and put together American history, for example, he took teams of archaeologists all the way from the Mississippi Valley all the way to the eastern coast of the Rockies, getting artifacts out of these mounds that were built. He got 12,500 of them, all of which he summarily destroyed on purpose to keep us from having to deviate from our customary versions of how America was discovered. It's amazing that this is an old story where
right.
We have been pushed and shoved into what we commonly believe is history, and there comes a point where academia becomes afraid, lacks the courage to discuss the truth.
But it cuts both ways, and I'll wrap up this thought on this, that the a couple of people have made the point that the Vatican was in dialogue with Islam, and there was to be a dialogue, a proposal to have a conference with all the Western religions. And this was supposed to include Islamic scholars and everything, and it was supposed to be, you know, kind of a symposium looking for common ground, a way of building toward a future. But it broke down on the subject of textual criticism, because the demand on the part of the Muslim scholars was that they got to maintain this belief that the Quran was the pure dictation of God, and that there could be no textual criticism of the Quran in this conversation. They could criticize the Bible, the Holy Bible, or any other religious text, but no other proponents of their religious text could criticize the Quran. And that's why it broke down. Now, I think that has implications to this story and how sensitive people are going to be if, in fact, they find more differences in this rediscovery of this older Quranic text.
Without any question, and that exceeds the boundary of just religious documents. This persecution of by academia, they felt this perceived threat on their part for massive change, has been around since the beginning of the Americas, since the beginning of the Revolutionary War and before.
All right. Now, before is where I want to get to. We have a little time left before we get to the phones. And I want you, Glenn Kimball, can you in a half hour tell me the story of King Arthur's brother coming to Mobile, Alabama?
Well, King Arthur...
Can you do it next? Can you hang up? Will
sure.
you do it?
Sure.
Okay. If you don't, I'll be scratching my head for the rest of this week wondering about it, and I have too much to do. So you've got to take me out of my misery. Got to hear the story. Glenn Kimball will tell it next, of how King Arthur's brother ends up in Mobile, Alabama. And then we'll get to your calls for Glenn Kimball in our last hour on Coast to Coast AM.
Sign up now for Streamlink, now with podcasting. Get it today at coasttocoastam.com.
So it started as a digression in our previous conversation, Glenn Kimball talking about the 7th century and what was going on when Muhammad was developing Islam. So one thing led to another. Next thing you know, I'm hearing Glenn just going to toss off, as Glenn does, going to toss off this fact that King Arthur's brother was in Mobile, Alabama. And I'm dying to know, how do we know that? And I know that Glenn will have a fascinating answer. We'll do that before we get to your calls for Glenn Kimball coming up on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So let's get to it then. The story of how King Arthur's brother could end up becoming the starting quarterback for the Crimson Tide. Exactly how did this happen? Exactly.
Well, let's look at the evidence first of all, okay? If you go to Great Britain, you go to the Stokedry Cathedral right there near Wales, near Glastonbury, they have a fresco on the wall that still remains to this very day. It has the depictions of King Arthur II, or some say it was Madoc, who was killed by Native American Indians. It has him actually being filled with arrows and the pictures of the Native American Indians. And people have questioned that for a long period of time until they began to get into the actual documents, the property documents, which are called the Landaff Charters. And by the way, my copy of that cost me a pretty penny. It really hurt my pocketbook.
Stop. Let me. What do you mean by that? How much would it cost you to get a copy of something like that?
It cost me $250.
Okay. Now,
these were like the county recorder documents at the time of King Arthur.
Okay.
That tell about who actually existed. There have been scholars and historians who've dismissed King Arthur as being a myth. Unfortunately, they have the property records of himself and Madoc, his brother, actually owning property. So he was not a myth at all. He was very, very real. When King Arthur was alive, he stood on Mount Tor, which was nothing but a labyrinth that looks much like the Mayan labyrinths today.
Right.
He said that his treasure was in Avalon. And Avalon was beneath the constellation of the Americas, the America constellation, star constellation, which was in the west. And his brother had already gone to the west, the land of the apples, and part of the reason why New York is called the city of the apples, you know, the big apple.
The apple.
but he came here and he settled here. As a matter of fact, Lewis and Clark, when they were commissioned to go and investigate all the way to the West Coast,
right,
they were given a Welsh translator intentionally so that they could speak with the Native American Indian tribes that only spoke Welsh.
Okay. A, I've never heard that. Fascinating. B, I want to go back to the images of Madoc being attacked by Native Americans.
Native American Indians.
Okay, what did they do to him? They shot him full of arrows?
Yep, killed him.
Okay.
And he left artifacts here, by the way. Adrian Gilbert's book on the Holy Kingdom. You know who Adrian Gilbert is?
I do. He's the guy who does the stuff on on the Magi.
On the Magi, he also did the book of the Holy Kingdom with Wilson and Blackett, who
right.
are the foremost scholars on King Arthur in the world.
Okay.
They have discovered the tomb of the original King Arthur there in Glastonbury. Their book on Arturo Rex, I've still got out-of-print copies on my website. It's the only place you can get them in the world. It's amazing what they have done, but Adrian Gilbert wrote the book for them because they weren't the writers that Adrian Gilbert was, but in his book, right on the cover, the paperback or the hardback version of the cover, was a sword, a Welsh sword that was found in Pennsylvania from the 7th century A.D. Now, how did that get there? And it was called the Sword of King Arthur. It wasn't the Sword of King Arthur. It was the sword of his brother Madoc who was here.
Right.
So we actually have artifacts that survive in the Americas from the time of King Arthur. And why did he come here? Well, he came here for a number of different reasons, not the least of which was this was the treasure house where gold was available. They could trade with the native populations for precious metals. But this was always the place for the transport of metals to the Far East and to the Middle East and to Europe. We know that back as far as the time of Hatshepsut in Egypt, the Phoenicians were importing copper during the Bronze Age for the building of the pyramids and afterwards. And where did they get all this copper? Certainly the copper mines in Egypt and the ones in Spain didn't come close to producing enough copper for the Bronze Age. Just the bronze alone that would have been required for the chisels to carve the pyramids would have exceeded the output of their mines there by tenfold. So where were they getting their copper from? Well, we know from reliefs on the walls at Luxor and places in Egypt that they were getting these skin ingots of copper from the Phoenicians, and the Phoenicians were getting them from Michigan. The copper mines in Michigan, as far
they were
back
coming,
as 1800 years BC.
So the Phoenicians were taking the St. Lawrence Seaway?
They were coming up the Mississippi and going through the St. Lawrence Seaway. They were going both directions. That's why when Christopher Columbus came on the scene, he really had two objectives. He wanted to get a passageway to Cathay, but he also wanted to stop on. He had a map, by the way. Isn't it nice that Christopher Columbus had a map?
Yeah.
And in the middle of the map is the a map of the Americas. I kind of figured that was kind of hilarious. But his second purpose in his own diaries was that he wanted to go to the land of the Garden of Eden.
Right. I've heard that. I thought that's always very interesting. But I'm stuck. I don't know. You can't get to Michigan from the Mississippi, can you? I mean,
overland you can.
Overland. But I just mean you can't get there just using the Mississippi. But going down the St. Lawrence Seaway, I could see how they would do
Which
that.
Which is even closer.
But how did they know that it was there, that the copper was there to be mined to take back to sell to the Egyptians?
Because the copper, the trade between East and West had already been long ago. We know
okay.
that we know that the original mummies from 2,500 years BC in Egypt, the nine sarcophaguses kept in Germany. Once again, we go back to this German confiscation of artifacts.
Right.
All nine of those mummies were tested to find out what kind of elements that they were eating, and every one of them had cocaine in their hair, and they were mummified with tobacco in their stomachs. Now, cocaine's only grown in one place in the world, and that's in the Andes Mountains, and tobacco's only grown in the Americas. And that fact is real. I mean, the toxicology reports are real scientific evidence that that trade was going on between East and West.
Interesting. So how did they know that he was killed, that Madoc, King Arthur's brother, was killed by Native Americans?
Because his body was brought back and buried and interred, and it's a subject of enormous numbers of paintings and reliefs in Great Britain.
So it was just Madoc himself that was killed, not all of his investigating party or anything.
Absolutely
like that.
Not all of them, because
okay.
they survived and integrated with the Native American Indian tribes, which learned to speak Welsh.
To learn to speak Welsh. And that's why Lewis and Clark brought with them a Welsh interpreter.
Exactly. They were assigned a Welsh interpreter.
Okay. I am completely intrigued by this. Every time I talk to you, I learn something new. Now, can we get an update from you before we go to the phones coming up? Because I know someone will ask if I don't. On the last time you and I talked, we were talking about documents that you had seen but were not yet available to you coming up from the Yucatan. You want to talk about that a little bit more?
Yeah, we're waiting to get permission for them to actually deposit them with us. I don't know whether they ever will. My MO is that if you're not willing to hand me the documents, I'm not certainly going to go to war to try and get a copy of them. I've always been had an open dialogue with people and say, hey, look, if you'd like to publish your documents, I'd be glad to help you with that. The majority of the people who have documents don't leave them with me, but I have enough that do leave them with me that it. I'm never going to be done in my lifetime with the manuscripts that I already have available to me that talk about history that has been eliminated from our schools and our history departments and universities.
Sure. One of those was this belief that there were giants in the Yucatan in the jungles, and that it was well known that there was going to be a photograph or a revelation that they were willing to make about these underground societies that exist in Mexico, right?
Yeah, actually, one of their messengers came right here to Arizona, and my son interviewed him. I wasn't here at the time. My son interviewed him. He was a representative of the six Mayan tribes that still exist in the Yucatan Peninsula. People say that the Mayans are extinct at the time from the time of the Aztecs. They're really not extinct at all. They just went underground. They live in the ruins in the Yucatan Peninsula and into Central America. And there's also tribal groups that live in the ruins in Bolivia, Chile, and Peru. You know, Red Elk is not wrong when he talks about the long walkers living in caves. I'm not sure that these were the caves, but they certainly were tunnels where people try and stay out of the view of ESPN or out of...
Yeah,
MSNBC.
They don't want to get recruited to play basketball. Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and you know, I took pictures of myself alongside two of the giant mummies when I was in Lima, Peru. These two mummies were 9.5 feet tall. They had their golden crowns, which would have gone around my waist. Of course, I was a lot thinner then. It wouldn't have gone around my waist. Maybe around my hand now, you know.
Right, right.
But their cloak, the woven golden cloak or cape that they had, was 14 feet high. Their gloves had fingers that were 10 inches, golden gloves, solid gold gloves. They were woven gold, so you could move them. But they were 10 inches long. I took pictures alongside these giant guys, their mummies. So the fact that there were giants that existed in Central and South America is not enough for me. In fact, those museums are still open to the public today. You can go down and take pictures today if you want to.
I was just doing a little Googling while you had mentioned that before, and so I was just kind of seeing whether there was other people out there that had made this connection on Lewis and Clark. And very interestingly, again, Glenn, always fun to talk to you, they referred to them as the Welsh tribes.
Right.
And they were looking for that at some point they thought Lewis and Clark might make a connection with the Welsh tribes, but they have them listed as being in California, or at least the one place I went to said that they were in California.
That's one of the places that they were located.
Okay.
There were Welsh tribes all across the Mississippi Valley, all the way west into California.
Okay. And
these Welsh-speaking tribes were not just isolated to California. I mean, and pardon me for this reference, but the proverbial Mormon pioneers had Welsh translators when they crossed from Illinois into Utah.
Right.
They had Welsh translators and spoke to some of these surviving Welsh Native American Indians.
Hmm.
So when you're talking about the influence of the Welsh in America, it's certainly way, way pre-Columbian.
Yeah, it sure is. I'm curious, too, about were there other records, Indian records, surviving that talk about the Welsh coming or King Arthur's brother? I mean, is there a corresponding version? Because that would have been a very early Western European exploration, right? I mean, if not the very first, it would have been amongst the first.
Well, the Native American Indians that we know today weren't largely writers. There are some pictorial,
yeah, that's
petroglyph
what I'm talking about.
Type things that are
right.
Rather amazing. One of the petroglyphs that I saw was a Native American Indian tribe carrying what looked to me, for all intents and purposes, like the Ark of the Covenant, carrying it through the into battle with them, with the cherubim on the surface of it, and it was absolutely amazing to me.
Well, doesn't that go to the story that the Ark of the Covenant is in Arkansas? I mean, isn't that something you told me once?
Yep, it sure is.
Okay, and that's why we call it Arkansas. And that the ark was brought there for safekeeping by whom?
Well, the ark was brought here by Jeremiah. Jeremiah, or the Odlam Fadla documents, by the way, you can find Irish Prince Hebrew Prophet on my website, which is the documented evidence of what happened to Jeremiah. Jeremiah took the daughter of King Zedekiah for her own safety. You know, Zedekiah and his sons were all murdered at the time of the Babylonian conquest. He took them out of there. Jeremiah was the one who stood on the wall and said, "Repent or we're all going to be destroyed." Ezekiel and Daniel all prophesied about that. Well, that happened. And he took the remnants to Great Britain for their safety. And that information is still in Great Britain. And the documents that survive in Great Britain are in this book, Irish Prince, Hebrew Prophet. Which is amazing.
No. And what other, before we get to the phones, let me ask you, what other things are coming across your desk these days that you're looking forward to being able to publish on your website?
Well, I'm just delighted to have the traditions of the early life of Abraham, which is the next things I'm going to be doing, all the writings about Abraham. Abraham is the connecting force, obviously, between all of the five major religions in the world. If you go back in the Old Testament, remember Hebrew means the descendants of the prophet Eber. Hebrew, Eber. He was alive just after the flood of Noah. And he had two sons. One was Peleg from the Tower of Babel, and he became the patriarch of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. But he had another son who was named Joktan. This is biblical. You can look it up in the Bible. Joktan went east to the larger populations of the world, which was China. And so the Abrahamic traditions were well accepted in China, whether we think our version of China today is via communism, not via what was really in existence in China. But Abraham is the guy who brought them all together, because remember that Brahma was the source for both Hinduism and for Buddhism. Brahma, who was Brahma? Well, Brahma had a wife whose name was Sarah, and Abraham was Brahma. And we have the text from very, very, very ancient scholars that talk about the early life of Abraham. And I think that this will be a way for us to amalgamate or to extend hands across religious traditions, all the way from Islam to Buddhism to Christianity and Judaism, and understand that we all had a common source we've deviated. We all like to think we own history. We like to vindicate our own traditions, our own cultures, our own race, our own people, our own politics. But the reality is that we shared many of the traditions in common.
Well, it'll be very interesting to see where we go when we get to the phone calls coming up in just a few minutes. As always with Glenn Kimball, you can ask about any of his work, and I know that there may be an update or two that I'm missing. I've asked for all the ones that came to mind with me, but I'm sure somebody will ask you about a past show. And then I'd love to get more questions, if I could, about this new Quranic text. I say new, newly available, thought once destroyed by the Nazis or Nazi-sympathizing academics in Germany after the war, but in fact was not destroyed. And a new version of this old text has become available, and scholars will begin to pore over it as it gets universal access for the first time ever, and we'll find out whether or not there are other disparities in other versions of the Quran, what that means to mainstream Islam, which maintains that the word of Islam in the Quran is the uncorrupted testimony, the recitation of the angel to Muhammad himself. And we'll have all sorts of different ways this last hour will go with Glenn Kimball next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.
Find out more about tonight's guest. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. Call the Wildcard line at 818-501-4109. The first-time caller line is 818-501-4721. To talk toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Ian by calling their in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 1-800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett.
And almost a full boat of calls, still a little bit of room for you. But the phone line's just given out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll pick it up with Glenn Kimball next in a variety of different ways. But if you missed it earlier, we'll cover part of this story of the Quranic developments this week, next two on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Glenn Kimball is our guest, and ancient manuscripts is the overall topic. In particular, we were talking about the rediscovery of a what had been thought was a lost version, early version of the Quran, which had been suppressed, as it turns out, for decades. Scholars not allowed to investigate it, not allowed to compare it. Very controlled access to it amongst a very small group of people, and now should be getting some general access, and it may or may not have any major implications for Islam as a whole, but there was enough fear of it being earth-shaking that it was kept out of the spotlight for years. Let's get to Mike west of the Rockies for Glenn Kimball in Phoenix, Arizona, on Coast to Coast AM. Mike?
Yeah, good morning, gentlemen.
Thank
Hi,
you.
Ian. Great show.
Thank you.
And as always, Glenn, you're a great guest, man after my own heart. Hello, neighbor.
Hello.
My question is basically, you were talking about in the Quran, the translation, is it Hur or Huri? And understanding of, well, I really don't know anything about the Quran or that, but my question is that in the ancient Egyptian religion, the Kemetians, the god, sun god Ra had 12 daughters named the Huris. I think that's where we get the term hours.
Exactly.
And now, is that a direct connection? Is that the same thing as to whether they're virgins or not? I would have no idea.
Perfect connection.
Okay.
You nailed it.
Okay.
Okay, but then that would seem to go against what has been an ongoing discussion on whether or not the proto-version of the Quran says Hur, H-U-R, as we're going to transliterate uh-huh. it, meaning raisins or grapes.
And in the Kemetian religion, from what I understand, the 12 daughters are the 12 fates, F-A-T-E-S.
Oh, that's interesting. I'd never
yeah.
heard that before. Very good. Well, I appreciate that. Glenn?
That's exactly right. But the Quran really did never imply that through some sort of jihadic movement that you were going to go be given virgins in paradise. That was never the intent at the time of Muhammad. That's a radical Islamic interpretation of the Quran. Once again, we're talking about varied interpretations of the Quran.
All right.
Which is not only a problem externally for the Quran, but internally as well.
Ray has a question or a comment for Glenn Kimball in Houston, east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Ray?
Hey, how you guys doing?
Good.
Yeah, first I have a... some thoughts to add to this and a few questions. The first thought is, how do we stop people, to come up with different versions? I mean, who is to stop people from coming on different versions of the Quran?
Well, I don't know what you mean, who's to stop them.
Well, what I'm saying is anybody can write different versions.
How?
I don't know. It's people out there, you know, they come out with different versions.
No, I you keep saying that, but I don't understand how. That's part of the reasons why this has been such an interesting discussion amongst academics and scholars, is they're really – to fake something like that is a lot trickier than you think and pretty easily exposed. You know, there's a story this week about a new – I think it's a 2,500-year-old – temple seal. Did you see that story, Glenn? It's on the Coast to Coast AM website tonight at coasttocoastam.com. A temple seal that may be 2,500 years old. Well, that's fine, but anybody who follows biblical archaeology knows one of the most faked documents or artifacts are these temple seals, and that maybe half of them that are floating around in and around museums or at universities are actual counterfeits.
Well, we look at one thing. I think you put your finger on something. It's a lot. We have to understand people's motivation. If you can produce an artifact that can be sold for money, it's more likely lends itself to being a fake than
right.
being a text tradition, which is very difficult to make money off of that.
Right.
In fact, you expose yourself to not only criticism but to violence, as we well as we've discussed here. And that's why a lot of these ossuary of James, et cetera, these kinds of things are probably faked because they were being sold for money. It almost goes hand in hand. That's why archaeologists have such a big problem, and why they've been so skeptical of Christian history, is because they found so many of these things that have been fabricated
right.
in order to be sold.
And Ray, just to the point real quickly, and I want to get your question, you said you had one for Glenn, is that provenance is really important. To be able to know the origin of anything, you just can't show up with it and go, here it is, and everybody stops what they're doing. It says, wow, something new. And there's a huge skepticism that exists on this. But so what was your question for Glenn, Ray?
The confusion in this subject, because it's so different than others, is if you're familiar with the Muslims and the Quran, they memorize this text from, I've done some research, they memorize from
sure.
day one. They memorized this text. So if it was memorized from day one, verbatim, word for word, because I have a friend who is Muslim,
okay.
he tells me about it. So if they've memorized it verbatim, word for word, then where does this question come from, a different version of the Quran? Because right now, as we speak, he himself, he's a Hafiz, which is a person that memorized, and there's millions of people
sure.
that memorize the Quran.
Let's not forget the significance of this. I think it's good to point that out. Let's draw the parallel this way, Glenn, that there is an earlier version of the book of Mark, the gospel according to Mark, than exists in traditional Christian Bibles.
That's correct.
In the earlier version of Mark, there is no resurrection story. There is just an open tomb at the end of the gospel, and everybody's amazed at the open tomb, and it's kind of hung out there like a cliffhanger a little bit. It's sort of this, then the tomb was open and Jesus was missing, but it doesn't go into the last 15 or so verses that gets added onto the end of the gospel of Mark. So I think that's what this points to. Now some people would say, well, just because it's earlier, it doesn't make it better. But many scholars would say the earlier it is, the closer it is to the original version, the better it is.
And that may or may not be true. And your caller is correct that even in the Arabic world today, people will gather and they'll say, recite what parts you can of the Quran, and they recite to each other the Quran. It's part of the memorization process. It's a mimic of what Muhammad did himself, because he could not write,
right.
That he dictated this thing. But remember that it's a lot easier to screw up your memorization than it is an actual text. It's the old party game. If you put 10 people
right.
in the line and you tell the bad
sure.
person a story, the story is completely different as it gets to the front, even if you've practiced it over and over again.
Let's get to Simon in Austin, Texas, on the wildcard line on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Simon?
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Thank you for taking my call. Glenn, I wanted you to expound a little bit more about Arkansas and what is there. I've heard you on previous shows briefly touch on it, and I think it's Mount Nebo, where the three rivers come together, and it's a flat plateau high, and what might be there and why a lot of people are drawn there.
Well, I think it really goes back to something very Aramaic, by the way. One of the oldest documents that we have in our possession today is an Aramaic document called the Lost Books of Eden. In the Lost Books of Eden, it tells the story of Adam and Eve, which is an extended version. It's probably
40 or 50 times as long as the rendition in the Holy Bible about the story of Adam and Eve. But Adam and Eve did not leave the east gate of the Garden of Eden, which is traditionally accepted that it was between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. They left the west gate, and that their descendants then migrated back to the east gate. And when they left the Garden of Eden, they went to a place called the Cave of the Treasures, and they lived there. It's amazing that they would say treasure. We're talking about the movie The National Treasures.
Right.
We're right now putting together a white paper, and we won't mention who we're presenting it to, but it's the people who know what they're doing and have done what they've done. That there really has been a treasure here in the Americas that is amazing from that old that time ago. The Cave of the Treasures is home. In fact, if you go to Egypt, which I've spent some time in Egypt with the wonderful and beautiful Princess Malak, who owns the King Tut exhibit, she took me on a barge cruise up the Nile River and on a carriage ride, several of them through Cairo. I've lost my train of thought, pardon me.
But all right, you hang on to that. We've got other questions.
When I think of a princess, I always lose my train of thought.
Let me get to Muhammad. He's got a question or a comment for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM on the Wildcard Line. Muhammad, go ahead.
Hi, I'm calling from Dallas, listening on 570 AM KLI, and I have 3 points to make. First, I would like to comment, Ian, on the courage for taking up this topic and presenting an alternative point of view, since I don't think many hosts would like to venture into this kind of a topic.
Thank you.
Even though sometimes I felt that I was listening to an evangelical broadcasting station rather than Coast to Coast AM.
How in any way did we get into an evangelical Christian point of view on this?
Well, it wasn't so much about presenting Islam, Christian point of view, as it was about bashing Islam and
How did we bash Islam? Well, this is Muhammad. This is the whole problem, and I appreciate your thought about being courageous. But to even offer what might be an alternate view, you describe as bashing, and it's that type of thing that gets really old.
Okay. There are a few things that you mentioned, like about conference to which Vatican invited Islamic scholars, and Islamic scholars said that they cannot criticize Quran. I don't think that's a valid point. You didn't say to which group of Islamic scholars that was sent. And I know several Islamic scholars who gave invitation to the Vatican, and their videos are on YouTube, wherein they invited Vatican for an open dialogue. But the Vatican said that we are going to have a dialogue, but it won't be an open dialogue. Okay.
Well, that's fine. All I can do is what I did was I read from a story on an Assyrian website. So
and what is that website?
But that doesn't have to. Hold on a second, Muhammad. It doesn't. I offered what it is, and I just said what it said. But, you know, I don't have to name the scholars. They don't name the scholars. So if I can't give you the names of all 38 scholars, you please don't interpret that as bashing Islam, that I won't mention the name of the scholars. I don't know the names. It was mentioned as part of the story that this is an implication that comes from being able to withstand textual criticism, and that mainstream Islam is reluctant to do the type of textual criticism with the Quran that mainstream Christianity or Judaism does with the Bible.
And by the way, I might add, the last person in the world that would want to diminish the great and important work that Muhammad did would be me. I have not only been good friends with the Princess Malak, who's Islamic, her husband was the King of Morocco, but I've had in my home this very day my granddaughter's best friend is from Islam, the tradition. Her parents are, and we love these people. And by the way, there's no greater advocate of the veracity and the serious and important nature of the Quran as I have. I have prominently displayed in my house, not the Bible, but the Quran.
Yes, but this question of bringing up an alternative text of Quran, this is a serious issue. And, I mean, I don't know much about Islam, but, I mean, I'm not an Islamic scholar, but this is a serious issue of contention. If you take up any Muslim, even if it's a Muslim scholar or any guy who considers himself a fringe Muslim. And this brings me to my second comment.
It's going to have to be your last point. It's going to have to be your last comment, but go ahead.
Okay. Actually, I asked for three, and you know,
I don't have time for all three, Mahan.
Okay. Since this is a serious issue, it would be better if you just instead of just presenting views of just one group, if you call an Islamic scholar from a renowned Islamic agency like Islamic Society of North America, which is a renowned mainstream Muslim organization in America, whose president was invited to the White House after the 911 attacks, those barbaric attacks. So it would be good if you bring in a scholar that is kind of, sponsored by Islam.
Right now, Muhammad, just we're talking about the story. So, I mean, when we actually Muhammad, when we actually get the texts and we have something to compare, I will tell you right now, I would love to have on a Muslim scholar. I think of nothing better than to have on an actual Quranic scholar and talk about the differences. Right now, it's just the story of the revelation. We don't have anything yet to compare of any detail. We just know that for the first time, the genie's going to be out of the bottle, or I guess maybe more accurately we should say the jinn is going to be out of the bottle on this, and we're going to be able to find out what differences may or may not exist.
And we
and
didn't create them. And you and I didn't create them. These have been in existence since the 7th century. We're only talking about the ones that have survived. And the fact that we talk about the ones that are Islam-based, that have come into our epoch of time pure and pristine from the time of Muhammad, you cannot say that only one survived, because it did not. There were more.
Well, and what will be interesting to see, and I think, you know, Muhammad actually echoes something that I would hear from somebody who's a very fundamentalist Christian. And what I would hear is I'll hear this when it comes up to a Christian text or a biblical text of some sort, is they'll say, hey, this is, you're bashing the Bible by offering a critical view of its contents, or that this discussion should only be held amongst people who are going to safeguard the message. And I think that's the part that I would disagree with fundamentally on this show, is this is not about safeguarding a preconceived idea of what this message is going to be. It's going to be keeping an open mind, just like we have on the show over the decades, keeping an open mind to what might be in these papers when they become available, and it looks like it's going to be happening soon. What might we learn? And let us be unafraid to follow this to the end of our thoughts, and we'll leave it there. We look forward to getting the rest of the calls, though, coming up, and find out where you want to go with this conversation with Glenn Kimball. We're talking about ancient manuscripts, and in particular, the revelation about these new Quranic texts that will become made available shortly to all of academia on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.
Miss part of the show? Listen online with Streamlink. Log on to coasttocoastam.com. 1-800-501-4109. The first-time caller line is 818-501-4721. To talk toll-free from east of the Rockies, call 800-825-5033. West of the Rockies, toll-free at 800-618-8255. International callers may reach Ian by calling their in-country Sprint access number, pressing option 5, and dialing toll-free 1-800-893-0903. This is Coast to Coast AM with Ian Punnett.
Let's get back to the calls right away. Glenn Kimball is hanging on Coast to Coast AM, and Ben is on the first-time caller line in Scottsdale, Arizona, for Glenn Kimball. Go ahead, Ben.
Good morning, neighbor. I had a, a question for you. For one, do we have any manuscript evidence of any of this trade that you talk about in the Americas? I didn't catch the whole show, so you may have mentioned this, going on down in sub-Saharan Africa. And also, was Africa ever part, was South America and Africa ever one continent?
Well, if Africa and South America were one continent, it was hundreds of millions of years ago,
yeah.
Under the idea of Pangaea.
Right, the continental drift, the whole bit.
The continental drift. When we talk about Peleg being around at the separation of the grand cultural separation, we're talking really about the events surrounding the Tower of Babel and the confusion of tongues, where people were scattered around the world culturally and linguistically. When you talk about manuscripts that talk about the trade to the Americas, of course. I mean, we have the Michigan tablets that survived. I mean, they tried to crush those out of existence. There were 32,000 of them in Michigan where the 2,000 copper mines were. We only have about 3,000 of them that remain. The rest of them were taken to a landfill and crushed by a D9 cat because people did, for various and sundry reasons, you know. I offer class. One of the classes on my website's about this thing and about the Egyptian reliefs, et cetera, that exist today.
In sub-Saharan Africa, too, was his specific point. Do you have anything on that?
Yeah, you bet.
Okay. Well,
Africa
good.
Was the site of enormous libraries, more than you can possibly imagine. In fact, the Islamic community itself has been a really excellent source of libraries, preservation of libraries. So one of the classes we just did this month was on some of the 40 to 60,000 Sanhedrin documents that survive in the Hagia Sophia under the Ottoman, under the old Ottoman Empire, where we have eyewitness accounts and testimonial affidavits about the time of the birth of Christ, and they heard the angels singing, and they had actual witnesses sign documents about this absolutely spectacular event. You want to have the thrill of your life, you ought to hear what they had to say about it.
Well, we have a full boat of callers. Everybody wants to talk with Glenn Kimball, so we'll just ask that everybody keep their questions as short as possible, and Glenn give you a chance to answer and try to get on everybody next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. Wildcard line, Alonzo is in Illinois on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Alonzo?
Yeah, I'm on.
Yeah.
Hello? Yeah, I have a question for him. What's this proof about the English coming to the United States or America in general?
The who?
Okay. The English.
The English.
Well, like I said, We have all kinds of documents. You can go to the Travel Council in Mobile, Alabama. They have a celebration of Maddox's visit in the 7th century A.D. We know that the Lewis and Clark were assigned interpreters, Welsh interpreters, so they could talk to these Native American Indians that spoke Welsh. Welsh, by the way, if you don't know what Welsh is from Great Britain, from Wales.
It is. I am British. I am English.
Good.
Okay. And your point then, Alonzo?
Well, I just like to know what documental proof, because you can say a lot of stuff like that, but there's no proof.
Well, hold on.
I mean,
you can
look at a tapestry and say so-and-so was killed by Indians, but
yeah.
What documental proof show it? There's got to be records of any type of voyage
I don't
in
know
the United
that,
States.
I don't know that there's a record.
I mean,
in
the monasteries of England with the monks and that, they wrote records down on everything.
I don't
but
know that
Columbus.
I don't think they have that. I don't think you can say that the monks would have written down, you know, somebody's leaving for the New World. Maybe they did.
Well, they did.
No,
it was well documented.
Go ahead.
To my website and spend a day. You'll find what you need there.
Go ahead, Alonzo, and then get back to Glenn on that. Michael is in Alberta, Canada, on Coast to Coast AM on the international line for Glenn Kimball. Michael.
Hey there, great to talk to you. It's a really interesting conversation tonight. It's great that you're spending some time speaking about Islam at a time when there's sort of a taboo against it almost. I just had a question about somewhere near the beginning of your conversation, you were talking about the translation of the word Huri. Now, when I'm reading up on it, the word H-U-R-I, Huri, H-U-R-I, seems to be a Persian word, which is the equivalent of the Arabic word H-U-R, the plural of Harai, H-A-U-R-A, meaning gazelle-eyed woman or virgin in common usage. So I want to know where you get this grape or fruit from the word H-U-R, Hur.
Well, we took it out of a dictionary from the time of a translation document from the time of Muhammad.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and that's as good as I do, you know.
Well, you know what, and Michael, too, here's what you want to do. There's a lot that's been written about that, going back to, I think, an article in Atlantic Monthly in 1999.
Right.
But there have been other pieces on this, including, again, it's sort of been revisited with this other discussion that's come up. So if you Google that, just Google, you know, virgin, you know, Quran, virgins, grapes, raisins, whatever. Just try some of those. You'll see some sites from people who have sort of dedicated longer form discussions about the word origins on that. Wildcard line, Kyle is in Ocean Shores, Washington on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Go ahead, Kyle.
Glenn, I have a question for you. You being an expert scholar, if I'm not mistaken, correct, of the Quran?
I'd love to think so.
Yeah.
Okay, well, nevertheless, I have a question for you. Does it, with a person of your background and your studies, does it at all concern you with the appearance of Osama bin Laden's son now on the political arena, the geopolitical arena, and how do you think that that's going to affect later on down the road? He doesn't appear to be a dangerous person, but clearly his presence will have an impact somewhere down on the road, especially him talking about wanting to be an ambassador of peace.
Right.
I am deeply concerned about that for many reasons, as you can imagine. So I'll go ahead and just listen if I could.
Glenn, were you up to speed on what he's talking about there?
You're asking me to be to comment on politics, and I don't know. I'm not a prophet or et cetera, but we know that the Bin Laden family is huge. They had many children, and the descendants of Osama bin Laden. We can't blame everything that their dad did on the children. Certainly, they have the autonomy and the right to have their own opinion and their own will. And I'm hoping that it'll be a form of reconciliation in the future. We certainly were the United States government is after Osama bin Laden for what he did, but we're not after his children. They probably had nothing at all to do with it.
So there was a conversation my wife and I had this week about Adolf Hitler's descendants that live in the United States. And People who follow the story know that they're Hitler's extended family, not any direct descendants per se, but lived in the United States, continued to live in the United States, I believe, and Canada. And they changed their last name, and they want nothing to do with their famous uncle or cousin, and they want to just be left alone and not bother anybody. And yet none of them have had kids. And I thought it was interesting that that it's almost as though they were trying to end the line of children, you know, that could in any way be related to Adolf Hitler. And then the same story came up about Osama bin Laden's son, that he married a 52-year-old woman. And I thought that's interesting because then, at least by birth, they won't be having any children either. And I wonder whether if Osama bin Laden is your dad, you might be inclined to want to end the family line, or maybe not. Anyway, all right, Albert is west of the Rockies in Northern California on Coast to Coast AM. Albert?
Hi, how are you? Yeah, Glenn, I was wondering if you can give me the name of one first century document that says Jesus was married to Mary Magdalene.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I quoted from one in my recent class. You can get the entire text off my website.
Can you give me the name right now?
Well, it's a document out of the Hagia Sophia.
That doesn't date to the first century. Nothing in the Hagia Sophia dates before the first century.
Well, you can claim that, but
no,
that's
I know
not
it.
True.
It's the consensus of all scholars, and you're basically just giving totally
Well, if
false
we're going to listen to scholars, we're going to be ignorant. I'm afraid that's the problem.
So you can't give me the name of one document.
I just did.
No, that's not first century. Anyone can look it up.
Hey, Albert.
Yeah.
This is the definition of being argumentative. If you don't agree with them, that's fine. But I don't know that you can disagree with the idea that yesterday's heresies are today's orthodoxies, and lots of things that would have been the consensus of scholars, say, in the 15th century, we know now as being totally foolish. So, I mean, I agree with you that that may be the consensus of mainstream scholars. I might be inclined to disagree with Glenn. But I don't know that it's fair to say that he didn't give you the name of one just because you don't like the one that he gave
you. Well, the Hagia Sophia, that's a general term for all the books found in the
Exactly.
Synod, you know, but it does. He didn't give me the name of a specific document in the original languages in Armenian.
Well, they didn't have names. They were documents. Well, it would be nice if they came out with nice little names saying this is document XYZ 1492 or whatever it is. But there is a manuscript that talks about the fact that Jesus was, in fact, socializing with Mary Magdalene during his lifetime.
So socializing in more than and there would be biblical scholars who would argue that there's lots of evidence for, there's strains of evidence of that pop up in the New Testament. Nothing clear, but things that seem to reference that. And we'll just leave it there for now. John is east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. John?
Ian, thank you so much for your intelligent approach to this whole subject and your calmness about this.
Try to, but I started losing my cool when Muhammad accused me of bashing Islam, so I got to watch myself. But
well, you're doing grand, and Glenn, thank you for your work. I had a question for you. I want to know exactly how you, in particular, as one person come in possession with all these papers, and basically I need a job, and if you need some help, I would love to help you.
Oh, that's interesting. Go ahead, Glenn.
Well, you're so kind, and there are so many people who would like to help me. I think that we need to launch a generation of people who do these research things for themselves. You know, you don't need to hang on to my coattail to do that, and I appreciate it very much. I don't know how to bring people up to speed unless you take my classes. And there are people who take the classes who bring me documents all the time. For example, the Rosicrucian documents that were the subject of a class that I offered 2 months ago were documents that were brought to me by a wonderful woman who had preserved them from 107 years ago, her grandmother. These documents were extremely precious to me. So
well, And the question of how these documents come to you, in some part, too, also has to go with the fact, too, you're the one looking for them.
Not only that, but one of my great friends of all times was George Eccles Cain, who was the grandson of Marion Eccles, the head of the Federal Reserve. He made a comment to me when I was young. He said, Glenn, you know, now that you finished your doctoral work at Southern Illinois, he says, you know what that really means? I said, no, what does that mean? He says, you know where the library is.
Yeah, you're just getting started.
And you know, we talk about handing around our credentials, our PhD credentials. That's just the beginning of our knowledge. And George, I thank you so much for teaching me what old money was all about and the kind nature of your family. They were very great philanthropists and helped a lot of people.
Let's get to Lee in Denver on the wild card line for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Lee?
Hey, good morning, gentlemen.
And
you know, it's interesting that the Nazis want to suppress this Quranic document because you're going to prove that this is fatalistic to Islam as a whole. National Socialism and Islam speak with the same voice. Mein Kampf, the Quran, the Hadith are all speak with one voice. Hitler based National Socialism on Islam, and that's what they're trying to suppress and hide.
I don't know that that's true that Hitler based it on that at all. I don't know that Hitler was even all that familiar with the tenets of Islam while he was developing his theories, but I would think that's too strong a connection. I think there's a dotted line, but I don't know that there's a big bold line. Glenn, where are you with that?
Well, I think Hitler was well familiar with the Islamic community. I think it's very difficult to lump everything together and to come up with a single conclusion. And that's where we usually make our errors is when we lump all kinds of different philosophies and tenets and suggest that Hitler really was the perpetuating an Islamic movement. That's simply not the case. Hitler was just as eager to find to invade the Habsburg Museum in Austria and bring out the Spear of Destiny, which he felt would protect him in the upcoming war, as it had for Charlemagne 56 times in his battles, as he was to protect the tenets of Islam. In fact, more so. So
that seems more like Hitler was very superstitious and very focused on myth more than it was any one particular religious tradition.
And it was a reflection of his mentor. Remember, his mentor was a mystic book pawn shop. You know, basically.
Right.
It's a reflection of his mentor more than anything else.
I think he had a lot of influences, and I don't think we can underplay. And there was a book written many years ago which really focused on the Austrian Catholicism that would have raised Adolf Hitler, and that the Austrian church was known for being highly anti-Semitic, and that was a big influence for Hitler early on. Hopefully that's changed. West Virginia. For Lee on the wild card line on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Lee?
Hi, Ian. Glenn, I wanted to clarify one thing for me, and then I just wanted to say something else. On the clarification, I was under the understanding that by the time the third caliph came into power, that there were already so many different texts that had been written and handed down between the different tribes that he had basically collected them all, burned them, and then rewrote it.
I heard that version too. Exactly.
Yeah, that's correct. But they survived. You can't burn them all. They survived. But you're right.
Yeah, and the other thing I wanted to just touch on there was, you know, with each of the major religions, with Buddhism, Islam, and Christianity, you know, the men and their lives, and then what came later is the religion. They actually didn't start the religions. It was the followers who started the religions.
And always true.
If we go back to the practices of the men themselves, their conduct, in a lot of cases, is totally different than what the religions came out of it.
A fair point, well made, and that'll have to be the last one. I think it's a good one to reflect on the fact that true believers are true believers, and we can all act in ways which contradict that which we said we believe in the first place. And we'll leave it there.